I'm going to call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and I am wondering if Representative Zalesnikar would like to approve a motion to approve the minutes from yesterday, February 24th.
Yes, I move to for the minutes.
All right. Representative Zalesnikar moves to approve yesterday's minutes. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor, aye. Any opposed? Motion is approved. Minutes are approved. All right. So, members, I want to start our very first DFL-led hearing this session, addressing the fact that we have been under federal occupation for 2 months now, and though it appears that many agents have left, Minnesotans are still in crisis, and that means a variety of different things for different people. But I don't want to waste any time not focusing on the issues to children and families all across the state. ICE activity has had a direct impact on our food banks and food shelves and local communities as families continue to be stretched to the max and trying to feed their kids. So it goes to show just how close all of us are to needing any type of food assistance services. We have Minnesotans who have always been able to support their families through honest work when all of a sudden, for the first time, depending on emergency food assistance from the state and their community just to not starve. So we are going to hear some of those stories today, and we are going to begin with a presentation from, the Association of Minnesota Counties. We have Commissioner Jenny Mongo, I'm pronouncing that correctly. You can correct me when you get up there, and as well as Barb Dahl, Social Services Director of Scott County. So once you get settled, if you could introduce yourselves for the record and proceed.
Good morning, members of the committee, Co-Chair Kanduza Wathun. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Katiza Wathun.
Sorry.
No, not a problem.
Thank you for the opportunity to be before you today. My name is Jenny Mojo. I'm a Clay County Commissioner. I'm Chair of the Board, and I also serve as the second Vice President of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Here with me today is Barb Dahl.
Yes, we again appreciate your time today. My name is Barb Dahl. I'm the Health and Human Services Director with Scott County.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I pronounced your last name wrong, too, so we're even. Go right ahead, Ms. Poncho.
No worries. Thank you. Again, as I shared, we're happy to be with you today to share an overview and information about the impacts as a result of the passage of H.R. 1 at the federal level. There are many significant changes in H.R. 1 addressing implementation needs and cost shares and shifts by the federal government. And it's a top priority across AMC and MACSA, among several other Minnesota county associations. Passed by Congress in the summer of 2025, H.R. 1, known as the One Big Beautiful Bill, contains significant changes within the Supplemental Nutrition Program Association, SNAP, and the Medicaid space. For the purposes of this hearing, we will focus on the SNAP program changes and anticipated impact at our local level. Founded in 1964 as the food stamp program, SNAP currently services 177,000 children, 70,000 seniors, 56,000 adults with disabilities in Minnesota. Counties determine the eligibility and operationalize the program throughout Minnesota's 87 counties. SNAP is an efficient and effective program, and as we experienced during the recent shutdown, is connected to local economies throughout our state. In 2025, Clay County administered over $13.2 million in SNAP benefits. This was a benefit not only to those vulnerable individuals who need it, but vital for our rural grocery stores and producers locally alike. In preparation for this hearing, I asked my social services director to pull the data on what we saw in Clay County. So he gave me a screenshot of the MACSA program that showed that there were 79,000 people in Clay County utilizing SNAP benefits. 79,000 people, when in actuality the population of our county is 65,000. So when we refreshed it, the MACSA numbers changed to show that actually we were, in fact, an audited number serving around that 6,000 individuals throughout our county. Administratively, the federal changes as of October 1st, 2026, states are expected to pick up an additional 25% of those administrative fees associating with administering SNAP. This is a new cost shift from the federal government and is anticipated to cost our state an additional $38 million annually beginning on October 1st, 2026. Clay County anticipates a shift of $392,137 as an additional cost shift. That number is more than some of our departments. We are forced to cut local needs, local citizen input needs to pay for these shifts. As of October 1st, 2027, states will be assessed a fee that is based on the payment error rate. And Barb will go into more detail about what goes into that payment error rate.
Ms. Dahl, go right ahead.
Yeah, before we leave this slide, I just wanted to highlight one additional piece. Today we're going to talk a lot about both the administrative and the fiscal challenges, but just the human challenge within this. When we talk about the work requirements, one study has noted that there's anticipation of having around 9,000 people in the state lose access to the SNAP program. And just thinking about that from a health and human services perspective, we know that that can impact some of our other social services programs. So we'll be navigating those elements as we also think about the administrative burdens as well. So looking at the next slide here, we just kind of want to take you into, this is a little behind the scenes on the payment error rate and what goes into that, because we're going to hear a lot about that. There's a big ticket item amount that's attached to this. So we wanted to be able to share a real example from Scott County. In fiscal year 2024, Scott County served 4,000 cases, yet only 10 of those cases were reviewed for payment accuracy. So 4,000 cases and 10 were reviewed, so 0.3%. Of those 10 cases that were represented, 2,113 in total benefits were issued. Of those benefit dollars, $149 was deemed an error, which is about an 8% error rate. And that's the official rate. And when you actually divide 149 into 2,113, it is like 7.05%. But actually, it's not just standard rounding. It's like really rounding. So that 8% could result in Scott County taxpayers having to pay a bill of over $1 million. So again, $149 in actual errors could actually trigger a really significant penalty. And that's not just Scott County. When we were preparing for this, Clay County had some initial numbers on the federal fiscal year 2025 and had about, so far, $59 deemed an error. And that could result in hundreds of thousands of dollars to that county as well. So what goes into, when moving on to the next slide, like what goes into the payment error rate? So the payment error rate does not reflect just how complex the SNAP and really eligibility determination has become. First, we should note that payment errors are not fraud. Errors can be a mistake really from the county agency, such as an overpayment. Or perhaps we actually didn't even pay the client enough when we were determining eligibility. We can also have client errors. In fact, in fiscal year 2024, 41% of the errors to counties came in the form of a client error. So these are things that aren't inside the county's control, but maybe a client, we give them so much information when they enroll, and sometimes we are not top of mind if they get an increase in pay or a job change or a shift change. So when we find these errors, we correct them. We recoup the overpayment. We can even increase the benefit if we'd underpaid them. So again, you've got client errors, you've got underpayments, you've got overpayments. Even if all of it is corrected, it's still part of the payment error. So another major driver behind some of this is also the policy in itself. There's no single source of the truth for errors to rely on. Just in the areas most prone to payment errors, such as income and deductions, we navigate dozens of separate resources totaling over 300 pages. And that just doesn't even include our core policy manual. So the level of fragmentation and inconsistency that it creates adds to the risk of the payment error rate. Also, we'd like to highlight that system workarounds due to this are routine. So when policy and technology don't align, and they often don't, workers must manually override the system simply to comply with the federal and the state rules. Each workaround adds time, and it increases the risk and makes us more vulnerable to the error. So when looking at really the documentation and the system that we have to work with, aging technology platforms are really a major contributor to the payment error and the workforce challenges. Our primary system, Maxis, which we talked a little bit earlier about, just trying to pull some data for this, dates back to 1989. It does not automatically calculate or tabulate correctly. It requires repeated keystrokes, and it forces workers to duplicate data entry and do manual calculations. In fact, it's actually easier to use, and we actually can't really use a mouse. It's easier to use the F1 key to navigate and toggle through the system. Training on Maxis is extremely difficult. For new workers, training can take well over a year before they're able to navigate the system confidently. And that's just the system itself, not the eligibility rules that lay on top of it. I don't know, when was the last time really any of us probably used a green screen as your major interface? But yet this is the major technology that we're asking our staff to do. And workers are juggling these outdated screens, complicated codes, and manual workarounds just to have the basic tasks completed. This legacy system increases documentation, it burdens and complicates work for families, especially children and families, and significantly impacts staff retention. We're asking people to do incredibly complex work using tools that simply aren't built on today's policy environment. Counties are already struggling to recruit and retain eligible staff. If we continue operating with outdated systems and manual processes, we simply do not have enough staff to meet the requirements, much less the payment error rate. This isn't a question of effort on behalf of the counties. It's just a question of capacity.
SNAP is a federal entitlement year, never intended to be funded by local, excuse me, SNAP is a federal entitlement program, never intended to be funded by local property taxes. HR 1 shifts federal financial responsibility onto counties, your counties. If counties are forced to absorb these costs, we will have no choice but to make cuts to other essential services. Services our partners, our local partners have deemed vital. Our shared goal is stable, timely benefit access. While we continue to advocate at the federal level with the USDA and our congressional delegation, we are here with a united, all 87 counties have identified this as their number one priority. And do you know how difficult it is to get 87 counties, 87 county boards to push forward a one singular priority? We ask you to.
So we'd like help and support in protecting counties from the cost shifts as a result of passing HR 1, especially the administrative cost shift where we lose 25% of our reimbursement and the cost benefit that would be shifted on to local property tax due to the payment error rate. Secondly, we want to be a partner in a solution. And looking at our modernization of our systems, that's the one piece that we hope can happen. Hopefully we can make a change and really impact the work that we have. We would like to just thank you again for this opportunity. We know that this committee and especially this legislative session has many competing priorities, but we really ask that this be one of those because it has so many cascading effects on the housing and the stability within our system, with other programs, and as we said, could cut vital programs if this isn't deemed as a priority. So we would like to thank Chair Katiza Wakun and members of the committee for your attention to this critical matter, and we stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that presentation. It was, just enough to impress upon us how serious of an issue and a challenge this is going to be for all 87 counties, and that is no small feat, getting all the counties to agree on the top priority for this session. So that really, I think, is helpful for the committee to know. Members, I will open up for questions. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here and giving us this information. I just wanted, first of all, to sort of clarify a few things that you mentioned. So the error rate, to be clear, that includes both over and under payments. Am I correct in understanding that? So even if the mistake, for lack of a better term, was on the good side, that the county did not spend as much money as they were supposed to, that contributes to that error rate number. Am I correct?
Correct. Director Dahl.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, it is client errors. It is overpayments. It's underpayments. And it's overpayments where we recouped the funding as well.
Follow up, Representative Colder.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for that. And you actually anticipated my very next question. And I wanted to clarify that 41% client error number, was that statewide? Was that for a certain county? What was that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that was statewide.
Okay.
In fiscal year 2024.
Okay, thank you. And I mentioned that because I think it's important, you know, we're not saying the hardworking county staff are completely off the hook here, but they are hardworking folks. But that almost half of this comes from the folks who are actually doing the applying, who are not county employees, who are, you know, just trying to get food assistance. And then my very last question, I promise, is, and you're on the county board, correct? You're on the Clay County board. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner,
Do you? And it's okay if you don't, because I'm kind of springing this on you. Do you have a rough estimate of, I know we're not in the property tax committee, but as a self-professed property tax nerd, I'm very curious, do you have a rough estimate what kind of levy impact this is going to have on Clay County?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. Clay County experienced a 4.9% increased levy. That was without substantial offsetting with reserve payments. Last year, we were looking at about a 16 to 17% levy increase. Historic. I recall Ramsey County Commissioner last week testifying that they saw 9%. These are historic numbers. What we're anticipating with the SNAP component will be 2 to 3%, which is substantial when we are going to our departments asking for a 0%.
Representative Colter.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those. I mean, those are just eye-popping numbers. And I mean, thinking back to my city council days, you know, 2 to 3% by itself was not, you know, that was a relatively hefty levy increase. So hearing some of those numbers, it's just really, really astonishing. And I think it's always worth remembering that local governments in Minnesota really only have a one-legged stool. They only have one place they can get revenue from, and that's property taxpayers. And so we're talking about either asking property taxpayers to pay more or to make cuts to other services that counties provide, like public safety and that sort of thing, or forcing more folks to go hungry. And so there's not much we can do about it at the state, but I think it is important for us to just kind of scope the size of the challenge. So thank you.
Okay. All right, Representative Perez Vega, I have you on the list, and your bill is, of course, up next. So, okay. All right. Representative Lee, if you have a brief comment, then we can move on to the proposals.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Just a quick point of clarification here. On the slide for Scott County, it says $97 million in statewide penalties, right? So that's money that's because of errors, administrative errors, like we're not getting from the government, from the federal government.
Director Dahl.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, thank you for highlighting that. That is correct. So if we are over a threshold, the state has to now pay that portion of the benefits. And so where we sit right now, based off of the payment error rate in 2024, is where that $97 million comes into play. If we go up over 10%, then we have a higher penalty, and it's 15% of the total benefits that would be paid. So that's where it's important that we're all working together to try to really lower that rate, because the financial penalties are substantial.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
So quickly, thank you, Chair. So the more errors, the more penalties. And then this is also on top of any other services that we would have to, again, absorb ourselves into the counties and the state, correct?
Director Dahl.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, you're exactly right. There adds additional layers and complexity of the work that's included operationally with this that the counties are having to absorb. Then there's the administrative loss of funding of 25% that right now is directed at the counties, and then there's this benefit share as well. So in total, I believe that the Department of Children, Youth, and Families cited around $145 million in total impacts, potential total impacts of this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Oldendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You know, I want to be solutions-based, and so in this presentation, you're talking about very much so what is going to happen to the state of Minnesota, but what I didn't hear is why and how can we help you? You know, the error rate is high, so that's not disputed, and I know one of them is the system. I've heard, you know, we need to update the system, but I would like to, it's just like a child, you know, just being very negative focused. We have to focus on solutions, so not just the what, not just that there is a penalty, but why are we here and how do we help fix it for you?
Commissioner or director, maybe you can touch on how Minnesota's error rate compares to some of the other states in the United States.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. We are, the reason I left a meeting and drove 4 hours to be before you today is because we want to be part of a solution. We want to actively figure out what a solution is. I'm very proud that our staff has a less than 1.8% error rate in what they're processing. If I could open my day with anything less than 20% of errors personally, I would be hitting it out of the park. I've never thought that in my professional life I would get to a point where I would refer to Oregon Trail as being a life-changing, historic advancement of technology, but really, in comparison to this, it is. Mm-hmm. And I might show that I was born in the 80s by saying that, but we are talking people needing to take a sheet, checklist things, add if a infant is a veteran or not, which most people would skip past. Part of the problem is if you miss a number in a password in any of your personal life entries, you will get a notification that says there's an error. One piece that can be added is to have that control listed on this so that if someone inadvertently skips a piece, it will not allow them to proceed further. Another item in Clay County that's been identified as a substantial issue is not having access to DMV records. When we're talking about asset input for individuals, if there is a car, for instance, that is part of an ex-husband's asset and they don't have access for that, most people would not enter that as an asset. Unfortunately, in regards to this, that would be part of it. So to have systems that speak to each other would be another substantial piece. Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Lesnikar, if you can be super brief with your comment, we're going to move to a couple proposals that might help us be solutions focused.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I look at this and I also want to look at the solution. I mean, the IT issues are as old as when I first started in St. Louis County, which is the largest county, in 1990. It hasn't changed. And so we made some things on this committee with SSIS, but, I mean, we don't have the $18 billion surplus. So here we are now. We have the problem. We have compliance to do. So my question is, if it was historic property tax increases this last time for you in your section of the state, is there anything that was passed recently that could be changed, modified to lower your costs? Because those costs got shifted from the state to the counties last biennium, is there anything we could do to help close that gap of solutions?
Commissioner or Director Dahl.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. I think that both the previous question and this question really point to the fact of what can we do not right this minute in terms of system modernization. And the counties are putting together, we're calling it a bridging package of really real-time solutions where counties have really tried to pioneer some lower cost system modernization elements and aspects that we could work to try to implement. There is a cost to that, and that's something that we hope to be bringing forward this legislative session as well, but it's more immediate fixes. And then we are really hoping that there is a longer term strategy, because operating within our existing green stream isn't adding the efficiencies that we need.
All right. Thank you so much for that. I'm going to give Co-Chair West the last word before we move to the presentations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming up with a solution. Well, a part of a solution on the spot, access to DMV records. Honestly, I assumed that you already had access. That seems like something we can do to at least assist. My question is, you know, Minnesota is slightly above average, I believe, when it comes to error rates. So basically middle of the pack. And that's an achievement considering the technology that we're hearing about. How does Minnesota's technology compare to other states? So other states have much lower rates. Some states have 25% error rates. How do we compare in that software department?
Director Dahl, or
Co-Chair West, that's a good question, and it's a piece that we have been looking at. There, we've been a part of a work group that has had regular meetings nationally to look at this. I think that there are some opportunities for us to catch up to where other states are currently, and even if we look to those that have lower error rates, how do we use program simplification and an opportunity to advance our systems to meet the error rate and hopefully serve Minnesotans better?
Co-Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that insight. That's one of, obviously, a thing we should pursue. The problem is, as everyone knows, we, the state, don't have any excess money right now. And money will be certainly a part of trying to make the counties whole. But as was mentioned earlier, your costs have been rising. You had 9% of those different levy increases and expect this to add on. So we have a lot of things coming together to make life a lot more expensive. as we go forward in session, just because we do not have any surplus money doesn't mean we can't reprioritize dollars that we already have. Given the rapid growth of government we've seen the last several years, the Minnesota state budget has skyrocketed in size. I feel like if we're willing to make the hard choices, we can certainly go through the budget and find money to help get through this era of rising costs. And I hope you'll be able to continue to, like, access DMV. That's not going to solve, that data sharing is not going to solve this problem. But share with us as many ideas as you have, and we'll be working together to come up with, I assume it's going to take a lot of different approaches because it's, everything is a marginal increase, but we'll do as much as we possibly can to make it easier for you to meet the targets.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to move to our proposals. First up, we have House File 45 from Representative Perez Vega, and testifier that we have listed is Tina England. If you wouldn't mind, Ms. England, coming up to the testifiers table, and we'll get rolling. Representative Perez Vega, whenever you are ready, go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Maria Isabelez Vega, representing this wonderful Capital Cities District of 65B and the beautiful suburb of West St. Paul. I'd like to move forward with HF 45, but I also, before then, have an amendment, the DE1 amendment, and ask to move that forward.
All right. Members, Representative Perez Vega moves the House File 45 is before the committee, and Representative Perez Vega moves the DE1 amendment. Any discussion to the author's amendment? Wise, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The DE1 is approved. Your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, HF 45. As we can recall, I came here last year to the committee to present the SNAP Outreach Program, which supports the work of organizations across the state helping enroll eligible individuals in SNAP. Appreciate the MCA for their description as how important these opportunities are that are offered in HF 45, because it would be a key connector to Minnesotans navigating the complicated SNAP assistance process, ultimately ensuring program compliance. The HR 45 as amended would restore lost SNAP outreach funding due to the impacts of what we just heard from HR 1. Prior to HR 1, the USDA provided a 50% reimbursement rate to eligible organizations for SNAP outreach activities. fees. Starting in October of 2026, the USDA will provide only a 25% reimbursement rate. This will result in organizations having to spend more money to do the same amount of work. If there's no additional funding for the program, we expect that the organizations will need to reduce the SNAP outreach activities or end the program entirely. As it stands, there will be less support for people applying for SNAP, less resources for SNAP outreach community partners, less opportunity for fraud prevention, and increased payment errors. SNAP outreach is completed by trusted community partners who are trained to be plain language translators who can help people navigate a complicated system. When high-quality support is provided, Minnesota can improve our case accuracy, reduce payment errors, support our local economy, and ensure Minnesotans are connected to the food support they need. Minnesota currently provides $500,000 in-state funding to support SNAP outreach activities, investing an additional $1.75 million in state funds will replace the lost reimbursements at the federal level. We cannot afford to lose this program right now. In a time where one in five Minnesotans is food insecure, funding SNAP outreach is imperative. I have witnessed in doing mutual aid efforts for my constituents who are suffering right now due to the effects of HR 1. And that is why I bring this HF 45 to this committee, because I believe that all Minnesotans deserve the opportunity to have food at their table. Food is an essential. Food is a human right. And as a type 1 diabetic who relies on insulin dependency, I relied on food dependency as well. And there's several Minnesotans here who would concur from the outreach in my offices. And I'd like to offer this time, Madam Chair, to our testimonial, Tina England.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Tina England. Thank you, Chair Katiza Watun, members of the committee. My name is Tina England. I am the Neighbor Services Operations Manager at Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank, where I have worked for 12 years. We are pleased to support HF 45, which would maintain funding support for SNAP outreach, avoiding those cuts made in HR 1. I am a veteran of the United States Navy and have lived experience using SNAP both as a single parent and as a child. I am a 30-year resident of Waseca in South Central Minnesota. I've run a food shelf in Greater Minnesota, and I've been a county worker. Now I work at the food bank. We are one of 28 SNAP outreach grantees in the state, and together we cover all 87 counties. This funding supports all Minnesota SNAP outreach grantee organizations. In 2025, SNAP outreach grantees like Second Harvest Heartland supported the completion of nearly 35,000 SNAP applications and recertifications. You've heard the importance of lowering and maintaining low payment error rates. SNAP outreach from trusted community partners, many with experienced staff, can help reduce those client errors. SNAP outreach grantees, like the team I supervise, provide one-on-one application assistance. This could look like completing the 10-page application form, explaining supporting documents that are needed, things like pay stubs, proof of child support, disability payments, assets. We explain how the process works, and applying for SNAP is a process. We make sure neighbors applying to the program understand there is a mandatory interview. There are deadlines. There are reporting requirements, and so on. However, our ability to be partners in accuracy will be diminished if funding is reduced. This could mean some of those nearly 35,000 or so applicants, neighbors who we assist now, clog up phone lines with questions about the application process or rule changes or program questions, questions we answer now. It could mean more incomplete forms or missing documents, which adds processing and handling time for county workers already working within a strict framework of deadlines. All things that could lead to higher payment error rates. SNAP outreach grantees are a crucial link, helping applicants accurately report and stay connected to their benefits, in turn helping county workers. With new work requirements and other HR1 changes to SNAP, HF 45 would ensure that Minnesota SNAP outreach remains strong. We respectfully ask for your support, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for joining us today, Ms. England. Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you. No questions?
Representative Donald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Perez-Vega, is this, if this should pass, would this go into a supplemental bill? And is there talk amongst both caucuses about a supplemental bill this year with, in lieu of a little small surplus that we have?
Representative Perez-Vega, that's a discussion that Co-Chair West and I will have to have with each of our leadership, but I think that we can hopefully all agree that making sure that Minnesotans have food on the table is a shared priority and just one of the many reasons why we're hearing these bills today so that we can look at all the options. Representative Perez-Vega, do you have anything else to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McDonald. These are the conversations that we deserve and we so can work together for all of our counties, it was heard, right? For all the counties that are requesting this and giving us the data that was provided today. I'd like that we can all be able to help and assist them to make sure that there's accuracy in what's needed and who needs the most vulnerable who are in need of this food right now. So I look forward to the conversations of having with both sides of the aisle as well as both wonderful chairs here to support all Minnesotans have access to the required essentials of food.
Right. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for calling me wonderful. I appreciate
yeah.
that. Question maybe for you or Fiscal. Does the federal government give us and give the state any money for SNAP outreach beyond matching a state investment in it?
So Representative Perez-Vega.
Madam Chair, currently Minnesota's providing $500,000 in state funding. Investing this would come from obviously our state partnership, but there is federal grants if we remember last year presenting that additional match of federal funds that seem to be vacuumed up right now. And so this would be able to help and assist in, where those federal funds are no longer available.
Chair West?
Anyone else would like to talk on behalf of that, but I think the answer is clear.
We will note that we got a thumbs up from Mr. Berg of House Fiscal. Chair West? Okay. All right. Wonderful. Well, any closing comments, Representative Perez-Vega? We'll move on to our next SNAP proposal.
I just want to say that, adding ridiculous work checks to make sure someone doesn't get $5 a day for food is just a roundabout way of voting to starve people. And that they don't want to cut SNAP, which primarily helps feed kids because that's a bad look, but make it impossible to administer it effectively is the same thing. And my constituents, your constituents, are asking for additional support. Our counties don't deserve to have additional work due to the cuts at the federal level. And this is a way for us to be able to do our job at the state to assist our counties and to assist all Minnesotans to having food as a human right. Thank you.
And members, with that, we will lay over House File 45 for future consideration from the committee. Next, we have an informational hearing from Representative Lee, feel free to head up to the testifiers table. The number is SC3756. When you are ready, Representative Lee, you can go ahead and introduce your proposal.
Chairs and committee, thank you so much. Representative XP Lee from Brooklyn Park, Champlin and Coon Rapids, 34B. Happy to be here as well as sharing about this great bill, talking about a Minnesota SNAP Bridge Program. So this bill will honor our commitment to veterans, seniors, Minnesotans experiencing homelessness, youth aging out of foster care, new Americans, and working parents who have experienced job loss. Because this bill would support those Minnesotans across the state who are at risk of losing access to federal SNAP benefits due to the H.R. 1 passed last year.
In Minnesota, this legislation puts approximately 27,600 individuals into this new time-limited recipients category, and they will be held to new requirements around work reporting, as we had just recently seen. A little bit of a breakdown is that 5,900 adults with children age 14 or older, 12,700 adults with dependents, without dependents, including seniors ages 55 to 65, and 9,000 vulnerable groups that were formerly exempt, including veterans, youth aging out of foster care, and folks experiencing homelessness, as well as the 9,000 legal immigrants of various backgrounds that are at risk of their losing their existing SNAP benefits. I had passed out and wanted to, at this time, point you to the insightful recent NPR article about Mr. Joseph Myers out of St. Peter, Minnesota, and his struggles and what he's scared of. And then also a letter in support of this program from the Partners in SNAP Defense Coalition, which includes notable organizations such as Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Minnesota Community Action Partnership, Second Harvest, Heartland, the Food Group, and many others. So this Minnesota SNAP bill will do three things. One, the bill will create a state-funded bridge to provide food support benefits to Minnesotans losing SNAP. That is going to happen in July. DCYF is asked to work with partners to determine the most appropriate and efficient state-funded mechanism or mechanisms and county processes to implement this bridge. Number two, it creates time and space for counties, tribes, and state-approved navigators to meet with Minnesotans face-to-face to determine whether they should be eligible for federal SNAP under an exemption. And that way, you know, they will continue to receive, hopefully, federal benefits. Number three, the bill ensures that Minnesota is capturing all potential federal dollars for eligible Minnesotans, but also ensures that our most vulnerable neighbors, especially, again, veterans, seniors, and people experiencing illness and or disability, are not falling through the cracks of this complicated and burdensome federal policy. From here, I'd like to move on to our in-person testifiers next, but in your packet, you do have some written testimonials as well. And I think Chair Tamara is next.
Yes. Tamara, if you want to approach the bench, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Next, we have Ms. Carlson, followed by Madeline Kincher. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. I am Tamara Walter. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I am a single mom of two from Blaine and a current SNAP participant. I face additional challenges feeding my family due to medical hurdles, including my children have type 1 diabetes and celiac disease, along with me living with type 2 diabetes. Our health conditions require a diet of high protein and lots of fruits and vegetables. Celiac disease is an allergy to gluten, and gluten-free foods cost 3 to 4 times more than organic foods. I recently lost my job, and I'm very concerned about the 20-hour work requirement, meaning that we'll be at risk of losing our food support while we're already struggling. I've been working very hard to find a new job that matches my skills and my schedule limitations. The barriers I am facing with my job search, one, is very competitive job market. There's 175 plus applicants per entry-level job. Two, it takes 2 to 4 hours to apply for just one job opening. Three, not making it past AI software when you apply to get your resume to be looked at by a hiring manager. 4, going through multiple rounds of interviews and not being offered a position. I keep putting one foot in front of the other, but I am growing weary, and it has been a huge financial loss. When I do secure a new job, I'm also concerned about keeping up with the additional paperwork. In my experience, all the extra record keeping and making sure SNAP has received it on time. This means more nights staying up late working on paperwork, loss of sleep, and a decline in my health, and making me less effective for anyone. And with no date and communication about when you have to be in compliance, what the rules are, and what happens when you're not in compliance, this is really stressful. If I drop below 20 hours a week for my kids or I due to illness or medical health conditions, this would cause us to lose our SNAP and put me in a state of constant stress, anxiety, fear, and inability to provide for my family on a daily basis. This is really unhealthy. When you're on SNAP and you're already at the lowest of low, this is hard. But without it, I don't know what I would do. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you for joining us and sharing your story. Next, we have Ms. Carlson. If you would approach the bench and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Due to privacy and safety, I'll introduce myself as Ms. Carlson. I'm a participant of Minnesota Safe at Home due to domestic violence. Because of that, I am a sole parent and a sole provider in every way. In 2022, I had a catastrophic medical incident that led to a traumatic brain injury. A brain injury can happen to anyone at any time. I was right downtown St. Paul in the ICU for 52 days. Prior to my brain injury, I was an incredibly hard worker. I fully supported my son and myself without child support nor public assistance. Thankfully, I did have some money and short-term disability insurance policy, but I also had to cash out my 401k account to support us. I am still very much in the medical world right now on a very regular basis. Part of my rehab, I was in a program for people with brain injuries, somewhat like a school class. The social worker there knew that I was financially struggling, and she led me to my county for financial and food assistance. Because of my traumatic brain injury, I applied for a Social Security disability. The initial process was more than 3 years. The judge partially ruled in my favor. He fully disabled me, but at the same time, he cut me off because I'm underage, and I'm retrainable, and I'm not. My understanding is it's much harder to be found disabled when under the age of 50. And then the grid rules can be used. Now I am over 50, and the law firm that is representing me has reapplied. Again, I've been fully disabled, and my brain injury will not go away. I am currently on SNAP. While I continued to wait again for Social Security. Now I'm at 3 years and 9 months. 3 years and 9 months is an incredibly long time of being in poverty and without financial security. I'm inundated with critical paperwork between the Department of Human Services and Social Security. And for example, with SNAP, everything must be returned on a deadline. And to be medically certified exempt My doctor also needs to fill out paperwork, okay? But doctors do not always have appointments available, and they book far out in advance. So there's that, the time constraints there. And failure to have everything returned can end the benefits, okay? And it's really hard to get back on the program, okay? While I was in rehab, I met many others with TBIs, okay? For example, my friend's brain injury, he became homeless, and severe brain injury prevented him from even being able to do basic paperwork, and he had many hurdles. He had a county worker, but he could not ever get a hold of her, and the worker kept changing, so he was stuck in red tape there, and so I would get food shelf food and bring it to him, okay? And I also have one more friend with cognitive deficits as well, and he can't understand the paperwork either. He got to the point of having a phone interview for SNAP, but then got a letter that he did not understand, and he gave up. So, and he also has mobility issues. So now he has to ride multiple buses to go to food shelves. He does have a worker, but obviously it's not helping, okay? And so not all disabilities are visible, and clearly many people are struggling just even with the basic paperwork. And I know that, like, the county workers are overloaded, but many people need help.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and that of your friends. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Finally, we have Madeline Kinscher. It's good. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madeline Kinscher. Good afternoon, Chair Kutizawitun and committee members. My name is Madeline Kinscher, and I am a public health worker with multiple years of experience in food security. This testimony is not affiliated with my current or former employer. I'm here today to ask you for your future support for the MnSNAP bill. SNAP is a critical program that feeds thousands of Minnesotans. About 45% of all SNAP enrollment is actually in the rural parts of the state, where food insecurity rates are high, if not higher than the metro, and there are fewer food resources available. In the metro, the cost of living and low wages forces people to choose between purchasing groceries, paying rent, paying bills, and other essentials. The loss of SNAP coming in the near future for a select group of people will deepen food insecurity in already insecure areas, bringing detrimental health impacts to all communities in Minnesota. Several years ago, I used to facilitate a local site for a statewide food distribution program in Wisconsin. I served a small city surrounded by rural areas. I served SNAP users, but most of the folks were low income or living on fixed incomes and were not eligible for government assistance programs. I remember giving food to people who traveled over 30 minutes to our local site, a veteran who became disabled and couldn't work but still had children to feed, folks who primarily spoke Spanish, college students, and seniors who were relying on Social Security. We served people from all walks of life because they all needed food assistance. The elected officials that they voted to represent them at Wisconsin's Capitol are the same officials who decided to remove the funding to preserve this program from the proposed state budget. This program provided nutritious, high-quality, and locally sourced food to their constituents' homes. My heart broke when I had to personally tell over 100 people that our program was ending because of this decision at the same time that COVID relief benefits were also stopping. The familiar feeling of heartbreak has now returned as I tell my community in Minneapolis about the changes of SNAP and why it's happening. I share a story from the state of Wisconsin to a room of Minnesotans because I'm hoping that you preserve the resources that are needed to help keep your constituents food secure. I am asking for your support of the MnSNAP bill. Our food system is already stretched thin, trying to fulfill the current hunger needs before HR 1 had suddenly put thousands of more people at risk for food insecurity. All of us, especially you, have a critical role to prevent hunger in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Members, I have two folks on the list, Representative Sensenmura, followed by Representative Olson, and I'm going to keep it at that since this is only an informational hearing, and if we take any action on this bill, we'll have to bring it back up for discussion. So Representative Sensenmura, go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair. So when I was hearing about this bill and hearing about the testimony, I was thinking of, I had a friend who, when she would do her to-do list, she would do, like, to do today, to do this week, and then things I'm ignoring at my own peril. And I just could not help thinking about that phrase as we talk about the devastating impact of this bill, because, you know, I've met with the counties, I've met with people in my community. People are describing the devastation that is going to come as people start to starve, but we're not there yet, right? And so it is somewhat easy in the seats that we sit in to be like, that's a next year problem, that's a next biennium problem. But these impacts are going to go into effect in 2026. By the time whoever of us, whatever conglomeration is back here, we're going to be feeling it really, really badly. And I'm just struck by that in this hearing of, like, what are we actually going to do? I mean, people are going to call us starving. I truly do believe, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but, like, I feel like people are going to call us starving, and there's no amount of money that we are going to be able to put in at the state level that is going to make up for this gap. And I know that some of you have seen it. You know, I've seen some of you write letters to your congressional delegation talking about some of the cuts that were coming to certain things, and I thank you for that. But I just feel like we are not talking about this enough, and it's going to hit us, and it's going to hit our communities, and we're just going to be in a world of pain. And I just, you know, I have to say, like, having listened to some of the State of the Union last night and just hearing, and I'm sure that I'm going to, you know, I have Trump derangement syndrome, but I don't know how to talk about what is happening at the federal government without talking about the actions of our president. And, you know, he kept talking about winning. We're winning. We've never been winning so much. And I just, like, hearing from traumatic brain injury survivors, diabetic kids, domestic violence survivors, seniors, who are all just literally begging us, help me eat. Like, is this winning? It does not feel like winning to me.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lee, welcome to the legislature. You know, I have a real problem with individuals who have a little bit more seniority and then they kind of pick on the new guy, so I'm not going to do that when we're talking about this. You know, I'm not going to try and set you up for failure here. Now, this obviously isn't a real bill. It's not introduced yet. We don't have a fiscal note for it, and that is, like, my tremendous concern with this concept, is that this could absolutely, like, if we're not already blown out of the water, this could sink our ship, all right? So that is a primary concern of mine. But I think it's also really important to recognize, and I know you probably didn't get this, so back in July of last year, MMB sent out an email, they sent out a presentation, they said this is what the new law is going to look like. And they specifically laid out who is going to be losing they're potentially losing their SNAP benefits, all right? So they said this, they said, and I'm looking at it right now, they say roughly 29,000 Minnesota adults could lose their benefits. And then they outlined who's going to be losing their benefits. And these are the people that you're trying to defend the position of saying these individuals deserve benefits, okay? So this is the conversation that we're having. Now, it says that it extends the work requirements for adults without dependents and without disabilities from the age of 54 to 64. So what you're telling me is that with this, you believe that a human being without any disabilities and without any dependents should not have to work if they're over the age of 55 years old. Now, I have a problem with that as an individual who plans on having Social Security being a problem for me to obtain. Like, I'm considering the fact that I might have to work till I'm 70 in order to get Social Security. And what we're saying through this is that an individual who is over 55 years old should not have to work. They don't even need to volunteer. They should be able to be a recipient of the gracious taxpayer dollars that we have. Like, let's be real. We have responsibility to our people. We have a responsibility to society. But those individuals have a responsibility to us as well. We need to take care of those who need it. But we have to ensure that people play the game the same way and they play fair. I believe very, very vehemently that an individual who is 58 years old and has the capability of working, because they're not disabled, remember, they're not disabled, and they don't have dependents, they should have to work in order to get the supplemental nutrition plan. They should have to. It should be a requirement. And this bill is telling us that that's not a requirement. This bill is also telling us that an individual who doesn't volunteer. Now, I've talked to a lot of people who are retired, and they tell me that they actually work harder in their retirement for volunteering than they did when they were actually working. It's very easy to find 20 hours of volunteering per month in order to qualify for these benefits. I think that when we're talking about, you know, thanking these individuals who came up, I do thank them for coming and giving their testimony, but we're hearing from people who have disabilities, we're hearing from people who have dependents, we're hearing from people who qualify under the current law that's coming into enactment in July. Where's the person who's 55 years old, not disabled, and not currently working? Where are they with no dependents coming and telling me that they need my money in taxpayer dollars to help them have food? I'm not hearing that. And I have a real problem with that, all right? And then we're talking about here, it even includes the fact that individuals who are currently going to be disqualified, those individuals who will lose those benefits, will have a three-month grace period to find a job or find a volunteering position in order to qualify for those benefits. I think that's reasonable. I could easily tomorrow find at least 20 hours a month to volunteer. It's very simple. You can make that happen. You have to give a little to take a little. And I think that what this bill is doing, what your bill is looking at doing, is not allowing people to actually participate. They're saying you don't have to do anything for the money that the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota are giving you. I vehemently disagree with it. I think that what we're looking at is helping people who need help and holding people who don't need the help accountable to participate in society. So I'm not going to ask you to, I'm not going to try and hem you up. I'm not going to try and pin you to the wall and make you answer questions. I appreciate it. I'm excited to meet you. I think you've got some great ideas to bring to this legislature. I look forward to hearing those. I don't think this is a great idea. I think it'll sink our ship. Thank you for the time, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee.
Representative Lee.
Right. Yeah, thank you so much for the comments. Chair, if I could respond to Representative Olson's.
Certainly.
Thank you. I definitely understand. I think, you know, the budget and everything is definitely weighing on all of us. And as was stated, you know, I mean, we could double, triple the amount of money that we're already putting in to this safety net system and still, may only meet just the needs that were needed, right? So as I understand it, the bill allows for the navigators of the county and the folks to be able to have the conversations with those folks to be able to make sure that, you know, if they can work, then they'll work. And if they can't, then they can be diverted to other, you know, resources. We didn't bring those folks because the assessment is pretty straightforward, like you're saying. We brought the testifiers that could potentially slip through the cracks because of the administrative or the legalese of the burden of work requirements and so on. But let me also pass off some of my time to the legal aid lawyer who's been helping with this bill, Jess. If you could introduce yourself.
Yeah. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then speak very briefly.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. Representative, I think you've mischaracterized the language in the bill. I'm not entirely sure where, where you're referencing that people don't have to work if they fall under the federal work requirement. I think what this bill does, what Representative Lee said, is sets up a rather robust assessment. And if you look at the very bottom, if you look at line 2.27 to 2.32, it talks about an emergency moratorium for folks who don't have a current medical, behavioral health, or vocational assessment indicating their ability to consistently comply with work requirements. And I think that you and Representative Lee are on the same page on this in caring about seniors, veterans, people who have barriers to employment, and maybe just haven't demonstrated those to the county and need an opportunity to do so. And I think that we'd be open to making those changes to clarify that if needed.
All right. Thank you so much for that feedback.
Thank you.
Representative Lee, if you have just brief closing comments.
Yeah, sure. I characterize it as a big cliff. And it's coming in July. I don't know if we can hopefully do something. I just dropped the jacket off today. It's actually my first one. So I just look forward to working with all of you to try to, you know, get this done. But Minnesota SNAP Bridge will help folks, these folks in particular, the most vulnerable folks, get from day to day. And that may not even be enough. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for your time, and thank you to your testifiers. Members, we are now going to move on to a bill from Representative Gander joining the committee, House File 3586. And I'm going to move that we re-refer House File 3586 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Gander, go ahead and introduce yourself and your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good that I'm getting out into the room here. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here today in support of House File 3586, which would establish a permanent regional food bank program. In a moment, I will allow our testifiers who are coming in by Zoom to share some details of the bill, which creates a more reliable source of state funding for our food bank system. I've known Susie Belter, Executive Director of the North Country Food Bank in East Grand Forks, for many, many years, and my wife and I have financially supported this food bank annually for as far back as I can remember. There is so much good that happens at a food bank. I don't know if you all have been there, but the last time I was there in the month of December, kids were just busily packing boxes of food for people to be distributed to their homes for Christmas, and it was just an amazing time. What is the value of kids being shown the importance of caring for people other than themselves? That's one of the really great things that happens at a food bank. So also in December last year, I visited every single food shelf that I could in my district. I got to about a half dozen of them, and it was pretty amazing. I saw a couple of things in action at each of these food shelves. Number one, the tremendous amount of love that goes out with that food. Number two, the mentoring that happens of showing them how to have a good quality of life. So at the point of distribution of this food, coming from the food bank to the food shelf, a lot of good things carry with that food. Number two that I saw, each of these local food shelves told me how essential their monthly delivery from the food bank is. You probably know what happens, but the food bank goes out with a truckload of food every month for these food shelves, and they receive this, and all they have to pay is for the cost of distribution. There's no more efficient way I know of distributing food to these areas. And again, they told me they love to receive the local donations of food, but they wouldn't be able to stay stocked without that monthly distribution from the food bank. So they described how all they pay, again, cost of delivery, and the food comes for free of charge. So at this time, I'll turn it over to my testifiers to give details of the proposed bill.
Thank you, Representative Gander. First on the testifiers list, we have, Susie Novak with the North Country Food Bank, followed by Shay Morris with Second Harvest Heartland, both virtual. And thank you for joining the committee today. If you could introduce yourself for the record, proceed with your testimony, and if you can, try to keep it to 3 minutes.
Yes. Chair Cotiza Whithoon and members of the committee, my name is Susie Belter. I'm the Executive Director of North Country Food Bank in East Grand Forks. First, I would like to say a big thank you to Representative Gander from my hometown for authoring this bill. North Country serves 21 counties across northwest and west central Minnesota. We're the backbone for nearly 230 agency partners, including 52 rural food shelves, ensuring that even our most remote neighbors can put a meal on the table. We provide everyday access and support, with most of our agency partners getting between 70 and 90% of all the food they distribute from us. We also show up during emergencies. For example, last summer we responded during the windstorm in Bemidji by conducting 2 mobile food distributions within 5 days of the storm. Food for Families is not partisan and shouldn't be political. In the rural communities we serve, we take pride in looking out for one another. We don't want our neighbors to be reliant on food support forever. Our goal is always to help neighbors get back on their feet. However, in the last 3 years, our distribution has increased more than 37%, a stunning statistic. Last year alone, we distributed nearly 7.5 million pounds of food. More people than ever need help just to get by, but the need continues to outpace the funding available. This bill, which creates the Regional Food Bank Grant Program under the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, is common sense. It matters for Greater Minnesota because food banks have immense purchasing power. All four regional Feeding America food banks in Minnesota have been working together to acquire food for distribution for more than 42 years. We are well connected. We have strong partnerships across the region and state. We are set up to move incredible amounts of food in a short period of time in the most efficient and cost-effective manner possible. We also have the ability to stretch a dollar to provide four meals. This matters especially now because between inflation, fluctuating egg prices, the recent uncertainty surrounding SNAP benefits, our neighbors are struggling to make ends meet. This $10 million annual appropriation ensures food banks have a reliable stream of funding to keep food shelves stocked at no cost to the local programs. Currently, state and federal funding represents less than 18% of our total revenue. We aren't looking for a handout. We are looking for a partnership that reflects the scale of the current needs. Our proposed formula prioritizes areas with high poverty and unemployment, ensuring that rural Minnesota families are not left behind. I urge you to support our Food Shelf Partners funding bill and this funding bill. It takes all of us to help keep our communities fed. If you are hungry, nothing else matters. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will move to Shay Morris. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Batun and members of the committee. I'm Shay Morris, President and CEO of Second Harvest Northland. So our organization acquires and distributes nearly 11 million meals within our 15 county, 27,000 square mile, mostly rural service region. Our food bank serves 11 northeastern Minnesota counties. Last year, Minnesota neighbors made over 9 million visits to our state's nearly 500 food shelves. That's a number we're not happy to share. Recently, high inflation, the end of temporary federal supports, mostly pandemic related, the government shutdown and SNAP pause have impacted working families, seniors on fixed incomes, and neighbors with disabilities. In fact, when the government shut down in our service region, we saw an immediate 16% in food shelf use. What's more, 26% of those neighbors said they'd never visited a food shelf before. One such neighbor, Ann, a working mother with two children, shared, "With SNAP being paused, I didn't have a reliable way to feed my kids. I learned about the food shelf, and it helped fill gaps with nutritious food." We know that more recent SNAP changes, like you've heard today, means that demands will remain high and more families like Ann's will need our support. In a perfect storm, our food bank actually started its fiscal year in July facing an estimated 1.3 million meal deficit in northeastern Minnesota due to federal and state food and funding reductions. Increases from donated food sources alone, like retail grocery stores and farms, simply cannot fill this gap. While government support makes up only 10% of our budget or resources, it's a critical safety net for the neighbors that we support. Why is this legislation vital investment? We need reliable and consistent base funding so we can be available to our Minnesota neighbors when they need us most. Our food bank started in the early 80s during a recessionary period that hit the Iron Range particularly hard. With thousands of miners out of work, and our food was a critical safety net for their families. Food banks remain an integral part of Minnesota's hunger relief system. We have been a reliable source of food for nearly 45 years. In fact, food shelves report that 70 to 90% of the food they distribute in their local communities comes from regional food banks like ours. Minnesota food banks also have a long history of responsibly managing the food and funds entrusted to us, upholding a high standard of transparency and accountability. While one-time support has been extremely helpful, base support will ensure reliable and consistent food to our nearly 500 Minnesota food shelf partners and the hundreds of thousands of neighbors we work together to support. I'd also like to add that we support our food shelf partners bill. We know from experience that the hunger relief system works best when we work together to support our neighbors facing hunger. I ask that you please support this bill to ensure that our food is available when our Minnesota neighbors need us most. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us from afar and sharing the stories of need from the greatest parts of greater Minnesota. All right, members, we will move to discussion. Not seeing any. Representative Gander, I will give you the final word on the bill. Oh, all right. Vice Chair Nelson.
Well, thank you, Chair Katiza Watoon. Representative Gander, I thank you for this bill. And is this the first time you've presented in front of this committee?
I knew someone. Madam Chair.
Representative Gander.
Representatives, indeed. This thing got a little chaotic at the end. It was going to be earlier. It was going to be later. I do owe you some sort of really nice treat, and I promise you it's coming.
You know, Representative Gander, I think that we'll forgive you since you are carrying a bill to feed kids and families all across the state. That's more important than giving us extra snacks. Vice Chair, do you have any further
thank
comments?
Thank you. No further comments.
Representative Olson?
Real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to say, $10 million is a lot of money. I hope we can find the money for this, but $10 million is a lot of money in a fiscal condition that we currently are in. So thank you for the bill. I hope we can find the money because, like has been said, food for people who need the food and deserve the food and are eligible for the food should have the food.
Thank you for that. Chair West, do you have a comment? Okay. All right. With that, then, Representative Gander, closing comments, and then I will renew my motion.
Chair Katiza Watoon, Co-Chair West, and members, we are seeing record-breaking need at our food shelves with more than 9 million visits last year alone. This bill will provide the certainty and stability our food banks need to keep their shelves stocked and our neighbors fed. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much. Now, members, with that, I renew my motion that House File 3586 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails, and you are on your way to Ways and Means, Representative Gander. Thanks for joining us today. Next up, members, we have our very own Representative Coulter, House File 3424. Please begin when you are ready, and we have a number of testifiers that joined us today in person. So first, after the member's introduction, we have Dom Corbel, followed by Patrick Felker. So if you want to come up and get settled at the front, go right ahead, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. You know, as I was thinking about today and listening to the conversation we've been having, you know, we use the phrase food security a lot. Because I think we're trying to be sort of exact. We're trying to make sure we're talking about the thing we're talking about. But I think when we do that, we kind of unintentionally sort of obscure the issue that we're talking about for a lot of folks. And the reality is that more Minnesotans are going hungry. Representative Gander just mentioned that in 2024, we saw a record 9 million visits to food shelves in Minnesota. And half of those visits, I should say, came from kids and seniors. That was an increase of 1.4 million from the year before. And for a sense of scope, that would be like the entire population of Hennepin County showing up at a food shelf the very next day. And we know that with the impacts that we are seeing from tariffs, from the upheaval on our farms related to immigration actions, to the cuts to food assistance that we have been talking about today, and just good old-fashioned greed, those numbers are only going to go up. And, you know, I think we all do agree that our food shelves do incredible work. The largest food shelf in the Twin Cities area, Veep, is in my district. I've had an opportunity to visit there a number of times and see just how dedicated the folks who work there and the folks who volunteer there are to our community. But we also know that they are struggling they were already struggling to meet the need, to meet the demand, and it's only getting worse. So, House File 3624 is an appropriation to our food shelf program. It's a program we have talked about in this committee before, so I won't go into too much detail, and I'll just turn things over to the smart people.
Before I move to testifiers, just briefly, Representative Coulter, I want to just correct myself. We are on testimony for House File 3624, not 3424. And
Madam Chair, I don't believe the motion is to send it to Ways.
Correct.
Just to clarify.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for that, Representative Coulter. So now we'll move to testimony. Dom Corbel, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dom Corbel. I'm the Executive Director at Community Pathways of Steele County in the great city of Owatonna. It's great to be back here again and speak again in behalf of this very funding that Representative Coulter brought forward. Down in Owatonna and Steele County, we distributed 2.5 million pounds of food in 2025 compared to 2.3 million in 2024. We had 64,000 food shelf visits in 2025 compared to 56,000 in 2024 and compared to 39,000 back in 2023. So staggering growth. And on top of that, our average purchase price last year went from 30 cents to 34 cents. And 4 cents doesn't feel like a lot until you're buying over a million pounds of food. It adds up. So this funding is obviously critical. It's one of the most important pieces of the budget that all of us who do this work put together. But this isn't about the funding, it's about the stories. And I want to share one with you that was 2 years in the making that I got to see a finish to just 2 weeks ago. 2 years ago, I had a individual come in, a mother of two children, came in with the kids but without her spouse, and said, we have just been basically struck by lightning. I was hurt at work, I'm out of work, my husband suddenly had a medical issue. We went from safe to unsafe in literally about a 48-hour span. And I got her set up in there, and she left feeling better about not having to worry about food, which is our job. The next week, her husband came along with, and he pulled me aside while she was shopping with the kids and shared this with me. He said, last week, I let my wife come here alone. I was in a mode of desperation. While she was here shopping with you, I was reviewing our life insurance policy to see what would happen if I took my life to protect my family. And he shared, I saw my wife come home from a visit with you at Community Pathways, and she had hope. Like, we could take away the worry of food together with you, and I had to come along to tell you today, thank you for that. But that's not the end of the story. It's as if he knew I was going to be here today. He showed up just earlier this week and pulled me aside, brought his kids in, and they made a donation to us of some food that they had collected from home. And the store and said, we're back and we're okay, but we never forgot about what you did for us. So when you have this funding, you of course know we're asking to buy things. That's what we do with money, right? But what this funding does for us, for those of us who do this work, is it helps us rewrite the stories of the people we serve, and stories with a much happier ending than what those stories would be without us and without you. So when you consider this funding that Representative Coulter is asking for in this bill, yep, it's a big dollar amount. Yep, it's necessary to buy things. But you have the power to change lives. That's when it happens, when you take away the worry of hunger. You change the story. So I hope you will join us and rewrite those stories with us.
Thank you so much for sharing that. What an incredible story. I'm glad to hear that family is doing well. Next, we have Patrick Felker, followed by Forrest Gregory. If you want to join the testimonies table, feel free to introduce yourself, Mr. Felker, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Patrick Felker, and I am the Director of Food Access Services with Family Pathways. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all about the Minnesota Food Shelf Program funding and what we are experiencing across our 7 food shelves and mobile program in Greater Minnesota. In fiscal year 2025, Family Pathways had 26,700 visits at our 7 Minnesota sites, representing a 14% increase over what we saw in fiscal year 2024. Of these visits, 2,408 of the families we served were using a food shelf for the very first time. This trend has continued into fiscal year 2026. To date, we have seen 16,695 visits to our food shelves. This is another 10% increase compared to the same point last year, which already had a 14% growth. We have seen 1,871 visits from new families this year, and this is a 29% increase of what we were seeing over last winter. Recently, I had the opportunity to be at our Chisago City Food Shelf, and I was speaking to a mother who was using our food shelf for the first time. She shared with me how difficult it was for her to reach out for help. Reaching out to us challenged her sense of pride, but her experience in our food shelf with the support we were able to offer and the dignity we provided made her feel like she's not ashamed anymore if she would need to come back. She shared after struggling for months, the ability to provide for her family with the assistance of Family Pathways restored her sense of hope. Like many food shelves throughout Minnesota, we are responding to double-digit increases in demand year after year at a time when our cost to purchase food keeps increasing. While we are deeply grateful for the generosity of our communities, 48% of the food we distribute is purchased. Funding through the Minnesota Food Shelf Program is essential to ensure that all 7 of our food shelves remain stocked with nutritious in-need items such as meat, produce, eggs, and other staples. Equally important is the flexibility this funding provides. It allows us to respond to the distinct needs of each food shelf to best serve their local communities. We are seeing the need for hunger relief grow in Greater Minnesota. Additional and sustained investment through the Minnesota Food Shelf Program will ensure that organizations like Family Pathways can continue to meet that need with dignity. Thank you so much for your time, Madam Chair and the committee, and we appreciate you supporting Minnesota families.
Thank you for joining us. Next, we have Forrest Gregory, if you're with us here in the room. Feel free to introduce yourself when you're ready and proceed with your testimony. And next, after Mr. Gregory, we have Ms. Jennifer Loon.
Hello, my name is Forrest Gregory. I'm the president of Ute Way Ministries, and we operate, one of our programs we operate is Manna Market. It's a food rescue and distribution program. I'm very nervous. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, so forgive me if I'm nervous.
You're doing great, and thanks for being here.
Where was I going? We serve, well, pre-pandemic, I mean, pre-ICE, we were serving about 2,500 to 3,000 families a week. When ICE hit, by early January, we were hearing from the people we're serving about all the horror stories of mom and dad eating one small meal every day so that the kids could have two small meals every day. And that's when we decided, okay, we have to get involved in the food home delivery program. So we basically shut down our drive-through operation and started doing just home deliveries. So now we're serving 5,234 families a week. We have a waiting list of, I don't know how many partners that want to join our effort. Two of the partners want 1,000 boxes per week each. We are hamstrung by food availability. We get, 95% of the food we get is from Second Harvest. So by supporting us, you know, you're supporting our efforts. I just want to read one email we got from one of the people we serve. And Latino lady, come on. Okay, here. And she says, "Hello, I just want to thank you for everything you do for us. Thank you for your time, your generosity, and for sharing food." This next sentence always gets me. "I don't feel alone anymore. I can feel that not everyone hates us. That shouldn't happen in this country. Thank you for your love. Every time I see the food, I feel like they gave me a hug. Thank you with tears in my heart. Thank you." So by supporting these efforts, you know, you're helping people like that. Just imagine what the kids are going through and what they're feeling and how they're growing up. This shouldn't be happening. And so I just ask for you guys' support and help. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gregory, for sharing all the impacts that your organization has. Members, next we have Jennifer Loon, who is a former state representative and no stranger to supporting children and families in the state of Minnesota. And she continues her community impact by serving as the executive director of the Prop Food Shelf in Eden Prairie. Please feel free to introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Loon, executive director of Prop Food Shelf in Eden Prairie.
And again, thank you, Chair Katiza-Watoon and Chair West and all the members of the committee for this opportunity. It's an honor to be back here with you today. I'd like to talk about food insecurity in Minnesota and what we're experiencing on the ground at a food shelf in the suburban West Metro area. A few key facts and statistics about Prop Food Shelf. We've been around for 55 years as a food shelf and a social service nonprofit. We have several other financial assistance and counseling programs. We focus on the communities of Eden Prairie and Chanhassen. And for calendar year 2025, we distributed nearly 1 million pounds of food, serving over 2,400 households, and those households contained over 8,000 individuals. For a little perspective, and I've been at the helming the ship at Prop for 4 years. 4 years ago, our poundage distribution was 530,000, so we've increased significantly in 4 years. We became a certified super shelf in July, offering our clients, shoppers, 100% choice, and that's one of the things that we do through our Food Mart to try to promote client dignity through the process of coming to a food shelf, which can be very difficult for people to do. All of this is happening in Eden Prairie, an area that some people still ask me are surprised to learn that we actually need a food shelf. Most of the people that we serve live locally. 68% of our clients identify as BIPOC, 34% are children, and more than a quarter of the households we serve are single-parent households. Food insecurity touches every community across the state as low-income households have been buffeted from the pandemic to record rates of inflation in rent and the cost of food, and more recently changes in federal policy, and the need continues to grow. In October and December, or October to November alone, during the disruption of SNAP benefits, we saw a doubling in our Food Mart visits and the number of clients we served. In just 1 month, demand surged at a rate that we typically see over the course of a year. In response, we piloted some new distribution models to try to meet the demand. Working with Second Harvest Heartland, we launched two mobile food distribution events, one in the mall parking lot and another at a large church. Over those two events, we served over 650 families and distributed more than 25,000 pounds of food. We also started piloting curbside express services on Saturday. We're not normally open on Saturdays at Prop, but we're doing that just to try to get food out to more people. We can push out more than 100 households of food in less than 2 hours. When ICE operations surged in our area starting in December, we immediately started to see an increase in our no-show rate. We do our food visits by appointment, and we immediately started seeing a rapid increase in that. People were calling, telling us they were afraid to come and get food. So by initially telling people, please use the ability to send a proxy if you can, we again had to pivot and find another way to get food to people who needed it. We had a small home delivery program in place for years, primarily utilized for senior citizens and the homebound, but we had to scale up very quickly to add to that, and we have now doubled that home delivery program in a very short period of time. So the reality is this, the demand is rising, barriers are increasing, and food shelves are being asked to operate more flexibly and more innovatively than ever before. Just like to thank Representative Coulter for a very bipartisan piece of legislation to help increase the state's support for food shelves. The MSSP grant is one that Prop has received, and while it's not a large portion of our budget, at times it has been one of the only grant sources that we have received specifically to help us purchase food, and we need that to help supplement what we get through food rescue and from the generous donations of our community, which does a lot of food drives for us. As a former legislator, I know of the difficult decisions you face when allocating resources and the many competing requests that you receive for funding. We are so appreciative of what the legislature has done to support this program. It helps ensure that we can have fresh produce and meat protein, which is two of the most highly requested items for our clients, in addition to non-perishable foods in our food shelf. We are committed to dignity, choice, and accessibility. But without sustained support and strong policy partnerships, community-based organizations cannot keep pace with the rapid pace of growth. Food security in Minnesota is not theoretical. It is measurable, it is accelerating, and it requires coordinated action. Thank you so much to all of you for your leadership on this important issue. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for joining us and for sharing the experiences of those in need in our community. Ms. Loon, and we'll hopefully have time to open it up for questions, but thank you for joining us. Next, and finally, we have Trina Thayer, who is with Food Without Fear. She is joining us via Zoom. So if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Awesome. Hopefully you can all hear me. I feel like we're many years into this and we're still, am I on mute? Am I not on mute? Good afternoon. My name is Trina Thayer, and I'm an Eden Prairie resident. And unlike my wonderful predecessors that have a long history of serving Minnesotans, I'm the founder of a brand new program called Food Without Fear. Food Without Fear is a grassroots movement started in response to the ramp-up of Operation Metro Surge in early January. I am not a nonprofit professional. I'm simply a Minnesota mom who saw the terror in her neighbor's eyes when they realized they could not feed their kids and wanted to help. We are also not grant funded. We are entirely funded by grassroots donations. The work we are doing, we hope, will take pressure off of these wonderful established food shelves, as they are also seeing a rapid increase in demand, as you've heard today. In early January, I saw a growing gap. Families needed hyper-local, immediate support. Many of them were unable to leave their homes for weeks, not because they had done anything wrong, but because the color of their skin or their accent made them a target. These families could not go to grocery stores. There are numerous documented cases of ICE kidnapping people at Target, Walmart, and other grocery stores. They could not physically go to food shelves. It wasn't safe, as ICE circled the parking lots outside their apartment buildings. And for many, even giving their information to organizations who receive government funding was terrifying. And I know I speak in past tense, and while ICE actions have ramped down, there are still hundreds of agents in Minnesota that were not here this time last year. At the start of January, food banks were not fully equipped to meet this rise in demand. Not because they're not doing amazing work, but because the demand for food support soared. Families who didn't need food support the week before because they were gainfully employed now needed it because they were afraid to go to their jobs. People could not physically visit the food shelf, so food could not be safely delivered. So to solve this challenge, I created a concept called food boxes. These boxes are standardized each week, meaning each family gets the same set of groceries. Each week we have a core offering, but we try to change things, a new fruit, a new veggie, different dry good or snack, and more. We do not means test our families. Schools, churches, and other organizations made the connections to us. And essentially, if you needed food, you got fed. It was the right thing to do. And while I'm so proud of the work we've done, the work that Food Without Fear is doing is supposed to be temporary. But at present, we are serving approximately 125 families per week. It is entirely volunteer-run and supported by grassroots donations. And we're really proud that we have been able to keep our costs at about $35 a week for a good week's worth of groceries. But that means it costs us about $4,000 a week to serve families. And being grassroots, we rely on donations. As donation fatigue sets in, there are all these families that will need to be transitioned to food shelves, and they need this funding to be able to take on that additional load. I want to end this by sharing how proud I am of my community. In 8 weeks, we have gone from not knowing anything about this landscape to being able to pack and ship 125 food boxes in a couple of hours. And let me be really clear about this. This was done by the power of the people in Minnesota, not the people in power. This is a testament of the men and women in our community who rose to the occasion because they love and care about their neighbors. Because when everything feels heavy and bleak, we remember who we are. We live here. We work here. These are our neighbors.
And Minnesota is a place where people show up for each other. And it's where we choose care over cruelty. And right now, that matters more than ever. And in this, I hope that it is time for a government to do the same, find the extra money, and take the burden off the individuals by allocating more funding to food support and these amazing organizations that are doing great work in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us and sharing that story. Right, we'll move to member questions and discussion. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Coulter. So this bill appropriates $5.4-ish million. We're likely going to have, I mean, if we manage to agree to budget targets, I expect a zero. Have you looked into anything within our area that you think we could reprioritize funds to get more money for your bill?
Representative Coulter.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. I have not dived that deeply into our budget yet, but as my wife would remind me, hope springs eternal, or she would say hope is a thing with feathers. So I'm still hoping we can, you know, search the couch cushions and find a couple of bucks for this. But I think that's, you know, as we've discussed, that's going to be the work of this session. And it's, I mean, I think it's work I'm certainly committed to, and I know everybody on this table is as well. At this table, not on the table.
Chair West? Different. Right. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we know how much donations, the funding from our nonprofits, so like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Brotherhood, or other churches in our communities, Lions Club, many other, you know, women's and boys club. I know that there's a large amount of money that's donated annually, but does the state or you, Representative Coulter, do we have any idea of what kind of money is donated through our local nonprofit groups and churches?
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald, for the question. I don't personally offhand know. I think one of the testifiers use the 48% of their overall revenue figure. I can't speak to how reflective that is, but my guess is that it for most, if not all food shelves, it's probably pretty close to that.
Representative McDonald, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. I think maybe that was Second Harvest that mentioned that, but I think that's good for us to know, since it is a non-budget year and money is tight. I think it's good for us to know and hopefully count on our nonprofits and religious faith-based, knowing that they are doing this work too. And I think it'd be good for this committee and all of us legislators to know that we can count on them. I know we can. Those who are in, you know, churches on Sunday or active volunteering in their nonprofit groups, this is what we do. But it'd be nice to have a number on that. You know, how much do the goodwill of the people of the state of Minnesota give to feed the poor and our neighbors? So we'll continue to dig on that.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill forward. I just want to say the quiet part out loud. And I think we need to be really honest and direct about this, about what the Trump administration is doing to the most vulnerable people in this country. As a single mom, I have lived paycheck to paycheck for as long as I've had children, which was when I was 17 years old. We've heard from other single moms here who have said the same thing, that this is a challenge. And so I want to remind ourselves that food shelves are underfunded in this country because the federal government is actively implementing starvation policies on the most vulnerable people in this nation. And if you Google federal starvation policies, you'll get results about ending hunger from USDA, Feeding America, No Kid Hungry, as well as articles that specifically call out what the Trump administration is doing right now with SNAP cuts. And his policy choices, these are choices, to quite literally take food off the tables of America's most vulnerable taxpayers, out of the mouths of babies, and out of the mouths of children, elders, and folks with disabilities. And for what? What's so important that we have to do that? Is there some big hole they got to fill, or what is it? Greed. It's for the purpose of feeding the richest people who've never known what it's like to struggle, who never will know what it's like to struggle because they have hoarded so much wealth that they'll never go hungry. And no one they know will ever go hungry either. So I just think as the richest country in the world, the best nation on the planet, we have to call this what it is and ask ourselves, why are we allowing our federal government to implement starvation policies? And here's a better reason. We can't overlook this because we're supposed to learn from the mistakes of our past, right? And we have all seen that Project 2025 is active and going, and it is rocking and rolling. And that calls for repeating many of the worst parts of history. And one of those parts of history that we have seen through the 17th, 18th, 19th century on this land were starvation policies, deliberate, systematic tools used to erase people that didn't fit the status quo that some people thought should be the dominant folks here. So if we can't acknowledge what history has taught us, we are damned. We are in a lot of trouble if we cannot honestly face that and ask ourselves, why are we taking food out of the mouths of babies in order to feed the richest people on this planet? And as a single mom, as somebody who actively today lets my son eat, because I can't always put food on the table, I ask us to really think about how we talk about these things and to remember that the people who need this are listening. People who are starving are listening. And if you've never taken care of somebody or tended to somebody who's been starved, if you've never provided services or casework or anything to a victim of torture, you maybe can't grasp this, and I understand that. But we don't have to walk a mile in someone's shoes to understand their experiences. All we have to do is listen to them. We have farmers on this committee who do what they do to feed people. That's like what they love doing. And I've heard you guys tell me that, right? And the worst thing we can do in the richest country on the planet is let people go hungry. It is so awful. And I'm just disgusted with what the federal government is doing to us. I'm proud of Minnesota for stepping up. I'm proud of our philanthropy here. I'm proud of our faith communities. I'm proud of everyone who's come together to try to fill this gap. But the reality is that we can make better choices than somebody who is in the pockets and riding the coattails and desperate for the approval and desperate for the attention of billionaires who will forget he exists in less than a year. So thank you for the time, and I appreciate it. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, I'm not one for bombastic shenanigans, just going all, I mean, but to be clear so nobody's confused, nothing changed in relation to children, babies being fed. If you have dependents, you are not required to do the work requirements. Now for older, like if your kids are 17, 18, you are. But the idea that we're taking food from babies is not true. So I would like us to stick more to what's in front of us today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair West. I do just want to highlight that, yeah, the work requirements are no longer to be waived for people with dependents who are 15, 16, 17, and 18 years old, often at a time in their youth, where they are eating more than ever before, and for families who are not going to be receiving additional supports for them, they may well have to reportion how many mouths in their house are relying on the food that is available. So while it may not be a direct impact to taking food out of the mouths of babes, it may well have that impact. We're running very short on time, Vice Chair Hansen. I apologize. We do have... Representative Coulter, you're going to renew your motion to re-refer House File 3624 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion is approved, and you are on your way to Ways and Means. Representative Coulter, you do have House File 1148, which we are going to lay over, but I know that you have two testifiers that are here with us today. Apologize for running late. So Eric Hedman and Faisa Ali, if you could approach the testifiers table and share your thoughts with us very briefly. We're glad to have you with us, and we will go ahead, Representative Coulter.
If I can, Madam Chair, there is the A1 amendment. Just very briefly, it just changes the bill from being a two-year appropriation to being a one-year appropriation. That's all that does. So if we can just adopt that, we're all working from the same homework here.
Thank you.
I'll move the A1 amendment.
Helpful. Yep, we will definitely do that next time. All right, Mr. Hedman, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee members. My name is Eric Hedman, and I am the Prairie Five Meals Director who was contracted to provide prepared meals to Minnesotans who are experiencing food insecurity and who are having difficulty preparing their own meals due to the limited mobility, disability, age, and also or limited resources. Sean and his fiance and their two kids, they live in a trailer home in a small western town. We need more food, is what they said to me. I'm trying to provide for my family, and we use the food shelf, but we still need more food. This is not an isolated statement. This household has steady income coming in each month, but they're still having problems with paying their monthly bills. 65% of the communities in Big Stone, Chippewa, Lac La Parle, Swift, and Yellow Medicine counties have a population of under 500 people. In the Prairie Five, the agency that I work for, service area, there are 15 grocery stores in a 3,000 square mile area. This equates to one grocery store per 200 square miles. Living in a small rural community, they may lack grocery stores, C stores, or they may have limited access to vital resources. Food insecurity is a major issue. And in some occasions, there are people in the five-county area that may have to drive anywhere from 30 to 40 miles round trip to get to the closest grocery store. Recently, we conducted a survey. The survey paints a picture of what the prepared meals participants are dealing with. 50% of the families worry that their household will not have enough food. 83% of the households stated that they face challenges on a monthly basis due to the lack of food. Surprisingly, 30% of the households also noticed a negative health effect on them.
Mr. Hedman, I apologize. If you could wrap up your testimony, we can
I'll do that.
Ms. Ali.
Living in rural Minnesota is a difficult thing, and that's something that people don't understand. Food access is important, and the prepared meals program has proven that it is sustaining and also supplementing people to live on their own. I thank you for your time.
Thank you for joining us. Ms. Ali, if you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Faiza Ali, and I'm a food resource navigator with Fairview Health Services. In my role, I work with patients who screen positive for food insecurity to connect them with county benefits, community food resources, and programs through our Fair Table Food is Medicine initiative at Fairview. The programs we offer at Fairview include the Fresh Food Box prescription, vouchers for healthy groceries, shelf-stable food bags at clinics, community-based food access programs, and medically tailored prepared meals. My job is to help patients understand the options available to them and finding a level of support that is the best fit for them. One of our most impactful programs is the prepared meals programs that we offer in partnership with Open Arms Minnesota. As current funding recipients, we are able to provide medically and culturally appropriate meals for patients who are food insecure, living with chronic health conditions, and have limited disabilities and mobility issues that are causing them barriers to accessing and preparing healthy meals. We also offer meals to caregivers and dependents to support the entire family. In my work, I want to share some stories of patients I've worked with that are in the program. One patient I've worked with is being treated for cancer and unable to work due to her health conditions. And on top of that, she's only leaving her house for medical appointments due to safety concerns in the Latinx community. She's only receiving meals from the Prepared Meals program. Another patient with multiple chronic health conditions, including a rare type of cancer, now receives meals to support his health. And this program also reduced caregiver stress significantly for his wife, who is dealing with her own health challenges and caring for him.
And on the younger side, I've worked with a patient in his 30s.
Ms. Ali, I apologize to have to cut you short, but we've run way over time. I bit off more than I can chew with this hearing today, pun intended. But I really appreciate everyone who came to share their stories from all corners of the state. Clearly, there is no urban-rural divide when it comes to food security or insecurity in the state of Minnesota, and we have lots more conversations to continue this session to determine whether or not we can make sure that no one goes hungry in the state of Minnesota. Members, with that, we are adjourned.